hello to all of you, wherever you are, listening to On the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter Haig.
Yeah, what are we doing this week? We're doing this week, I think, what you might call
it. Still in Oregon.
It's just kind of like a little piece of heaven.
Yes.
A little piece of heaven called the Oregon Wine Country. And
We're not physically still in Oregon, but
no.
We are in the program still discussing our trip to Oregon.
And our taste buds are still enjoying the beautiful wines that we drank everywhere we went in the restaurants in Portland. And we had the opportunity to sample some wines ourselves in the wine country. But first up, we visited a property that's beautifully located right on the edge of the wine country in Newburgh, Oregon, that we went to first about 2 years ago, just after it opened. It's a wonderful hotel and spa called the Allison. And we interviewed the chef who opened that restaurant, and we went back, and of course we interviewed the chef who's now working there, whose name is Sonny Jin.
And really remarkable.
Yeah,
remarkable man.
Very interesting chef. And the property was also interested in letting the world know about a developing program of cheeses in the hotel. So we had the opportunity to talk to the man whose idea it was and who's now in charge of putting that program together.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just the very beginning of this program.
It's pretty exciting. And we had a wonderful dinner shortly after as well, where our friend the cheese man proved to be very good as our wait man and also our sommelier. So
multi-talented
guy. We had a wonderful time with him. First of all, Sonny Jim, and then cheese at the Allison.
But I have to say that I would like to spend some time in the future, more time at that spa, which is gorgeous. We've arrived at the Allison Inn and Spa in Newburgh, Oregon, and we're pleased to be talking with the executive chef. I'm having a hard time talking today. Sonny Jin. Sonny is a nickname or not?
Sonny is a nickname. I was born in Korea. My full name is Sung Ho Jin, but I've been called Sonny since the earlier days.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it stuck with me throughout childhood.
Yeah, well, you have a Sonny personality, so that's good.
Well, could be worse, I guess.
Well, we were just catching up a little on your history, because I had read bios, and mm-hmm. You have such marvelous experience of who you've worked for and with. Let's start back at the beginning. As you said,
sure.
You were born in Korea, but you grew up in Minnesota.
I did, in Rochester, Minnesota.
Right, which is the home I learned at the Mayo Clinic.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But you had no ambitions to be a doctor. You had no connections with the medical community.
Zero.
I understand that one. But you've always loved to cook, you
Absolutely.
Said. So there was no question when the time came, you decided to go to culinary school in your mid-20s.
Yes.
And where did you go?
I went to Western Culinary Institute here in Portland, Oregon.
So this is how you became attached to the community.
Very much. I mean, I left my heart here back in 05 when I went to school and just come back to find it again.
What did you love most about it?
The weather, the people. I mean, I can go on and on. And the
They're
Pinot,
friendly,
the microbrews. Yeah, there's really no end to it.
Right. All this access to fresh produce.
Oh, absolutely. The growing season here is tremendous. We have such a wide variety and wide area to expand on ideas or really create things from our garden and from our surrounding purveyors.
Well, your experience, as I said, is like top of all marks. Your externship was first at the French Laundry with
yes.
Thomas Keller. How long were you there?
Well, it's funny. I went to the French Laundry for my externship. They asked me to commit for 3 months. I gave them four. After the 4 months were over, though. Well, I pressed on this, and I really wanted to work there, and I just knew that that was where I needed to be. So I worked hard and eventually was offered a job and stayed on for 3 years.
So you were there a long time. Who was the executive chef?
The chef de cuisine
at the time
was Corey Lee.
So you know Corey then?
Yes. Yes,
very
well.
Have you been to his new restaurant?
No.
I haven't either.
I haven't had a chance to go there, but I'm hearing just the best things about it.
Oh, yeah. We didn't make it this last time we were in San Francisco.
Yeah, I'm crossing my fingers.
Oh, good. So there you have what has been voted top restaurant, top chef in the country.
Yeah.
But from there, you sail off to Australia.
Yes. Then, yeah, as much as I loved the French Laundry and would immediately go back in a heartbeat, I just needed to see what else was out there. And one thing that's always eluded me was my lack of knowledge for fish and seafood. So I did some research and sourced out Tetsuya's, and they gave me a lot more insight. I am not afraid of anything from the sea anymore.
And you loved Australia, which we all do.
Yeah, Australia's, right. I mean, they're great people.
From there, you were so addicted by this time to perfectionists that you moved on to El Bulli.
Yes.
With Ferranadria.
Yeah, no, that was quite an adventure in itself, too.
That has to have been amazing. Wouldn't it have turned upside down everything you had learned up to that point?
Well, yes and no. I read the books, seen the movies, did as much research as possible, and, you know, I got to say, I have a lot of respect for how he can turn any ingredient into so many different preparations and just completely wow you. That's exactly what I needed. And that's how I ended up there.
Well, here we are at this point.
I mean, how do you get into a place like that? I mean, everybody wants to go cook there.
Yes.
Yeah, but look at his experience.
But you were there. You were there for one complete season.
I was. I was
there.
That
must be pretty unusual.
Well, I wanted to fully commit. I could have gone there easily for a month or a week. However, you really don't know the dynamic of any kitchen in a short stint. And I wanted to know it through and through. What made them, number one, so many years in a row? And why are they on top of the game? And why is it that everyone wants to go there?
Well, what was your conclusion?
I now know.
What?
That Fran Adria has an excellent team behind him. He has an amazing chef de cuisine, Oriol Castro, who develops the menu. And every day, we worked long hours, but I would never beat him to the restaurant, and I would always leave before him. The gentleman put in some tremendous hours to make it the success it was.
Yes, I mean, it's really amazing, though, but does this relate to your philosophy of cooking much?
Well, the molecular gastronomy side of cooking is not exactly the path that I've chosen for myself, but that was one that I didn't know very much about, which is exactly why I ended up there. I learned how to, I don't want to say manipulate, but enhance ingredients into something completely different.
Now, do you think that this shift to this new Nordic cuisine just shifted us all away from that a scientific kitchen approach? Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's a whole new direction we're headed in now?
I think that's a touchy subject. As much as I love molecular gastronomy and everything that it's giving and has given, I'm such a traditionalist at heart. I love classic French food, and I think that's the direction I'll be going.
Is that what you do
personally
here at the Allison?
Yeah. We strive to grow and produce as much as we possibly can here on our grounds.
You have a garden.
We do. We have a half acre, and we have a proposal for an extension coming here shortly. And cross my fingers, we'll start raising some animals as well. We've actually toyed with raising a pig recently, a red wattle. We got him when he was a suckling, took him all the way to 300 plus pounds. We finished him 60 days on hazelnuts. And the last day of his existence, he had 5 gallons of Adelsheim Pinot. Yeah, no, he was a happy pig. And we made sure of it.
And you killed him, though. I mean, you harvested him.
Yes, and then we gave him the full glory of having his own menu. And
Did you really? When was that?
That was a while back. It was somewhere in midwinter.
You nicknamed him what?
His name was Dinner.
Dinner?
I don't know if I should be saying that.
That's pretty funny. That sounds like a wonderful, wonderful event.
It might have been better to call them breakfast, really.
Yeah.
Now, I told you that we were here with this predecessor of yours when they opened the Jury. Why don't you explain? That's the name of the restaurant here at the Allison. And what does that mean, Jury?
Jory, yeah, what a great name for our restaurant, and very fitting as well, considering that that's exactly the soil type that we're on, is Jory soil.
What is that?
It's soil that actually does very well for the growing of grapes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a vineyard type soil, and I remember Nathan telling us that they got the name from that. And you actually have your own vines growing on the property, right?
We do. We have our Allison Vineyard, and we're crossing our fingers. This year should be our first vintage.
So You have a winemaker?
We do. We've partnered with Adelsheim Vineyards, and they are in charge of our grapes and bottling and the entire process through.
We should slide back to the food, shouldn't we?
Well, we are, but I wanted to say I had one thing else to get in while we're talking about this. You said you did not meet your predecessor, whose name was
Nathan Lockwood. And it's unfortunate that I didn't have a chance to meet him. I think
we would have been great friends.
We
interviewed him, you know, here. Uh-huh. But you said that you've looked through the venues and he shares your philosophy.
Oh, absolutely.
Never got around to what your philosophy is.
Well, his pairing of foods and matching to the seasons is what every chef really hopes to do if they care about seasonality, locality, sustainability. They just go hand in hand, and he did it very well.
And this is very major for the Allison because it's a gold LEED LEED certified property.
Yes.
Peter is anxious to talk about the food. I can't believe he's hungry again, but I guess he is.
Maybe I should have brought some potato chips.
We have some.
I wasn't anxious to talk about the food. I know we have to get some food into this interview, and if we don't let Chef go back to the kitchen fairly soon,
we won't get
There won't be any dinner for anybody tonight. So we do have to worry about that too.
Let's talk about your menu. We know it's seasonal. We know it's local as possible, and we know that you now cook. You're not afraid of fish, but we're in a meat area too here too.
Very much.
Could you pick out some favorite dishes that we might be having tonight and tell us about them?
Oh, absolutely. Let's take one dish for example tonight.
Okay.
We have a farmer or a group of people right on the other side of the hill. I don't want to call them farmers. They're more friends than purveyors to me.
Okay.
They're the Kurs. They raise eggs, and we get their eggs. They do a lot of lettuces for us that we can't do ourselves. And they came up to me today, and they said, we're sitting on a lot of corn, probably 100 years.
Okay.
So I was talking to my sous chef, and we were sitting there trying to come up with an idea for our dish. And I think you might be able to see this on the menu tonight. We're going to take their corn. They have two varieties, a super sweet, I think it was called like a candy corn, and a red varietal. I'll have to go look at the names. But we're going to take those, make a risotto with it with a little bit of lovage, and serve it with some scallops. The rest of the dish is yet to be put together, but you have the base.
Take another. Let's have another example.
Sure. Another thing.
I like the way you talk about your thoughts, what the motivations for producing these dishes.
Oh, absolutely. Tomato season is just around the corner, too, and we have over 50 varieties of tomatoes currently planted in our garden.
Heirlooms.
Yes, all heirlooms. And we are just days away from swimming in tomatoes. So now we're trying to find ways to best utilize the tomato without overdoing it as well. So we're coming up with side dishes of tomatoes, and we also have heirloom tomato salad that's served with house-made mozzarella, some crispy avocado, some pancetta, and we'll probably do something like a tarragon creme fraiche on the plate, something just to tie it together.
Sounds great.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
You said you love French cooking. So
I do.
Yeah.
Very much.
Tarragon, that's good. And are you going to garnish everything with purslane? That's what I found out about Oregon.
You know, that's funny. I've managed to stay away from purslane this long. I mean, one variety, golden purslane, I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd rather use it as a garnish than a main staple of a dish.
Yeah, we eat it all the time. Well, I'm not going to talk to you about desserts. We're actually, you do a fantastic job with cheeses, and we're going to be interviewing your cheese person.
Yes, Ron Acierto.
Acierto.
Yes.
Okay. Is that Italian or Spanish?
He is Filipino.
Filipino. Okay.
Yes.
Well, you better get back, Sonny, to the kitchen, and we'll talk to you later.
Absolutely.
Sure we'll see you in the dining room.
And thank you for your time.
Yeah, and I guess we'll add that you have a chef's table, which would be exciting if anybody wants that.
We do. We have an eight-seat chef's table, which is open to dinners. It's right in the heart of the kitchen. It's full on action. It's very interactive. A lot of the times the chefs, we just collect ourselves and bring the dishes out and we explain it ourselves.
Well, I'm looking forward to trying this. It's certainly a pleasure meeting you.
You as well.
We now are having an experience at the Allison. I'm talking to the man responsible for your cheese, how it's handled, what goes on your cheese board and so forth. This is Ron Acierto. Is that the pronunciation?
Yes, ma'am.
And you were really not from here, but you've been here for a little bit now. But you have a restaurant background that goes quite deep.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, but your switch to being a cheese specialist was fairly recent. You said you started the cheese program at the Allison last October 2010.
Yes, I spoke with the sous chef of the restaurant, and I asked him if I could help him put together a menu along with him helping me educate everybody else about cheese. And I took over in last year of October.
I mean, did you start from scratch buying the cheese carts and the...
There was already a cheese cart when I took the program. There were a few selection of cheeses when we started, but there was never a description or a proper menu when guests would ask, what are your cheeses? Either we would have to ask the chef, what's on the cheese board tonight? And that was a constant issue because the staff were never aware what was in the cheese menu, so it was not as well sold or well informed to our guests.
Well, do you actually come to the table with a cart and introduce people to the cheeses?
We started not doing that way. However, when the sous chef and the rest of the staff in the kitchen agreed that that's the better way to present cheese, we started talking to Pierre, the GM of the hotel, to maybe get a brand new cheese cart to accommodate of all the cheeses that we'll probably include. So the owner of the hotel, Ken Austin Jr., who's a certified woodworksman, he does a lot of woodwork as an artist. Chef Sonny talked to him if he could put together a new cheese cart for us, and he agreed. So we had the measurement, got together, and that was finished right around February, March of this year.
Is it temperature controlled?
No, it's not yet temperature controlled. Hopefully soon.
Ah, I see that glint in your eye.
Yes.
You have great plans for this program, I can see.
We're hoping to add more and more international cheeses as well as very local artisanal cheeses.
That's my next question. I mean, what percentage is local and what percentage is international?
Right now on the cheese menu, we have about 7 of the 13 cheeses are from Oregon and Washington. And
Rogue.
So Rogue, we have their Caveman Blue, of course.
Yeah, favorite cheese. Yeah.
We have Briar Rose, which is down in Dundee, about 5 to 7 miles away from here. The owners actually personally deliver the cheese to us. We don't have to have a distributor for it. And there's a few from Rivers Edge Creamery in Logsdon, Oregon, which is southern Oregon, 8 miles east of the Tillamook Coast.
Wow.
So,
and in your international list, what are your favorites?
At the moment, the one I have on the list, it's called Soto Saner al Tartufo, which is...
With truffles.
Yes, a cow's milk with truffles from Venice,
Alba.
Italy.
Yeah. Oh, Venice. Okay.
Yes.
I was going to say Alba.
It is labeled as Venice. It could be that they are sourcing from the local outskirts of Venice as well.
And your opinion, people say that wine kills cheese and vice versa. How do you go along with that?
There are some wines that will kill cheese. However, there are many great varietals as well as many wines that perfectly match with cheese. So it could be either way, depending on your palate and what you perceive that wine will kill cheese or not, but I don't believe in that. Wine and cheese go perfectly well together. It's like champagne and strawberries.
Uh-huh. So if you were to do the ideal match of a cheese with a wine, what would it be?
The classic one would be, and I would go it for all the time, is Sauternes and blue cheese.
Well, I can tell what we're going to have tonight.
Yes, we do have a local Semillon dessert wine from Arbor Brook that would perfectly match with either the Bleu de Verne or Caveman Blue. You can have that this evening.
Well, there's so many wonderful cheeses in the world. You're going to have a lot of fun, I think.
I am. I'm really excited about the program. Right now, the 13 cheeses that we have on the menu is set for now, and then hopefully Chef Sonny and Chef Trent will help me with the next phase in the fall, and we're going to either add or delete a few other items and get a little bit more variety in there. There's one called San Simon. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. It's from Spain, and what they do is they put the cheese in a pear-shaped metal mold, and then after the cheese starts to harden, they hang it and then let it smoke for 2 weeks, because it's considered the gourmet of smoked Gouda.
I see.
Beautiful cheese.
Well, you should try that Sardinian with the maggots in it.
I've seen that before, but yeah, I don't know.
I don't even like to think about it.
I don't know if our clientele here
is
ready for that yet.
I'm not ready for it.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Ron, for talking to us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
To seeing you in the dining room.
Yeah, we look forward to serving you this evening, and we'll have some fun with some of our great food from Chef Sunny, as well as our cheese cart.
Right.
We'll see you tonight.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And stay with us, because we'll be back after our show.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, next up is, we've been a fan of Elk Cove wines for how many years, Rabbit?
Oh, well, the first wine we drank was 1982 La Boheme. So it's been almost 20 years, and it's been almost that long. Adam Campbell has been the proprietor and winemaker, although I think his father still has a share in the property. Adam is quick to point out that he now does all the work. And we
had a nice visit.
We had a lovely visit at this hilltop property, which is just one of the most beautiful places on this earth, especially if you're interested in wine.
And I love his new dog.
And you love his new dog. Fine. And so here's Adam Campbell, winemaker and owner of Elk Cove Vineyards in Gaston, Oregon. If your idea of heaven is a hilltop with a pond and wonderful flowers and vineyards as far as your eye can see, then the place you want to come is where On the Menu is today, to a place called Elk Cove Vineyards outside Gaston, Oregon. We've been here before, but we've never met Adam Campbell, who's the winemaker at this establishment. So we made the pilgrimage again to see, and we're reminded again just what a wonderful place it is. You must feel really fortunate, Adam.
Yeah, to get to come here every day. It's a place I grew up at, but I still, especially as an adult, I think, see the wonder of the beautiful property here.
I can't imagine how you can focus on anything besides the views, because I never get tired of just looking around.
Yeah, I guess the grapes keep us focused in that there's no stopping them. They're growing, and they'll need to be harvested here in the next month or two.
And you had a unique experience of learning to be a winemaker. You said you learned on the job.
Yeah, I learned from my father. He was a self-taught winemaker, and we started here planting grapes in 74 and as a family and lived here at the property. And I learned from him, and he was the winemaker for 20 years, and I took over about 15 years ago. We still own it together, but my parents are both retired.
And the specialty, because we're in Oregon, the specialty grape is
Pinot Noir. It's and other cool climate varietals. It's definitely a cooler climate here than almost any other quality wine growing region in the world. And so focus on Pinot Noir. Probably 90% of my energy goes into that. But I also make some really lovely Alsatian varietals: Pinot Gris, Pinot Blanc, Riesling.
Are you still doing the Viognier?
A little bit, yeah, from southern Oregon, from a vineyard that is a little bit warmer than we're here.
Oh, I see. So it wasn't grown. The Viognier we drank was not from here.
Yeah, it's southern Oregon's a good little bit warmer than what we are up here. So we couldn't really do Viognier up here. We need to stick to Alsatian Germanic varietals, Rieslings, Gewurztraminers, Pinot Gris especially for whites, and Pinot Noir. If we work really hard, we can get it ripe. And
now, when we were members of your wine club, the Roosevelt Club, I think we bought several percentage points of the Viognier harvest because it was fairly small.
Yeah,
we loved it so much.
Yeah, we only make a few hundred cases, but it kind of fits one of the things I like to do, which is in addition to Pinot Noir, which is over half my production, to do these fresh white varietals in a stainless steel, kind of capture the fruit style, and Viognier fits into that. I love aromatic varietals, and I love white varietals that don't see oak aging.
Now, is there something pretty unique about this site? I mean, it seems like it's way up high, higher than most of the vineyards in Oregon.
Yeah, so most of the vineyards in Oregon are centered around the northwest corner of the state in the, you know, what we call the Willamette Valley. And we're at the very northern edge of that. And Elk Cove is unique in that it's a big property. It's over 200 acres here, but it's also kind of tucked up into the Coast Range. So most Oregon vineyards are hillsides, but just above traditional flat ground farming. Where Elk Cove is another 300 or 400 feet up in elevation and really kind of almost in the Coast Range.
What does that give you in terms of a differentiation of your wine?
We love the site here for its freshness and acidity that we get in the grapes. Because it is a bit of a cooler site, it doesn't get quite as hot in the heat spikes of the summer, and so it's a little bit moderated. We have to pick it a little bit later, but if we work really hard in our vineyard management, we can get perfectly ripe grapes at the very end of the season, which is the goal.
Oh, well, then, wonderful. Now, I've always been entranced by the titles of your wines. Who names them?
Oh, you know, me and my folks work hard on coming up with different names. And
I mean, like La Boheme.
Yeah, it's a pretty romantic name. You know, my parents are definitely opera fans. To be honest, what got us calling that vineyard La Boheme was the fact that the people that homesteaded this property, gosh, 150 years ago, they were French descent, and their name was Boheme.
Oh, really?
And so we just always called that part of the vineyard Boheme. And
yeah, we passed it coming in.
Yeah. And then, you know, we have our, probably one of our more famous vineyards is Roosevelt. And that's named after the elk that migrate through our property every year.
Now, why is that named?
Oh, sorry. The type of elk we have here in Oregon are Roosevelt elk.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Named after Teddy,
okay,
who was
yeah.
quite the outdoorsman. There was a lot of famous Roosevelts, but the Roosevelt elk here are named after Teddy Roosevelt.
You have to be a Democrat, because the Republicans say Roosevelt.
Yeah, that's right. I always say that we, you know, we hedge our bets, and that Teddy was a Republican, Franklin was a Democrat.
Yeah.
So whichever one you prefer is what we named it after.
Very good. So what are some of the other names of you?
We have a vineyard over just east of here called Five Mountain. And that's a vineyard. We didn't name it ourselves. We purchased the vineyard 5 years ago, but it's named Five Mountain because from that vineyard, you can see the five peaks of the Cascade Range, which would be Mount Hood, just directly east of Portland, but also Mount St. Helens, the volcano, Mount Rainier up near Seattle, Mount Adams, and Mount Jefferson.
And have you experimented with sparkling wine at all?
We do a small amount of sparkling wine.
I don't remember a sample of that.
I always tell people, come to the winery or come to a wine dinner. That's the best way to taste our sparkling wine, because it's a very, you know, such a difficult wine to make, but it's super fun. And I try to make just small amounts that we can show off at wine dinners and things like that.
You have a membership club called the Roosevelt Club, right?
We do. So we have
from which we were fired because we're in Pennsylvania and
yeah.
the shipments couldn't come through anymore.
It's really hard. Some states we can ship to, some states we can't. We try to be pretty proactive about being licensed to sell in all those states. But Roosevelt Club's a great way, 2 bottles of wine every 2 months, and you get, you know, my take on the vintage and the wines, plus wines like that sparkling wine that we don't sell to anybody else.
So. Now, your wife is Australian. I mean, were you in Australia for wine reasons, or how did you meet?
We met when traveling, backpacking through Europe when we were, I think I just turned 20, so we were quite young. And I followed her to Australia, but she's from Sydney, and there wasn't a lot of winemaking opportunities in Sydney, so I went to school at the university there in Sydney,
uh-huh.
and then after about 10 months, I convinced her to come back to Oregon with me.
So you've been in she's been in Oregon, you've been in Oregon ever since?
Yeah, almost 20 years, and I'm fortunate that she loves Oregon as her adopted home, and we have 3 small kids and live out on a vineyard, a little bit of the way I grew up.
Yeah, that's going to be a pretty special way to grow up.
Yeah, it's, I mean, when we first started here, it was definitely the infancy of the Oregon wine industry. So as a kind of a farm kid from a rural area, but my parents were growing grapes. I think, all my friends thought it was pretty weird that we were doing grapes.
Well,
but
where were they from?
My parents are from Oregon. My mom grew up on a pear farm beside a Hood River, and they both grew up in Hood River. And so my family's been in farming in Oregon for four generations, but my parents wanted to do something different, and they were really into wine. So even though there was only a couple hundred acres of grapes in Oregon at the time, they took the leap of faith. And
that had to have been gutsy.
Yeah.
At the time, right?
Yeah. I asked them the other day, I said, when you planted these, 10 acres of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, had you even ever tasted an Oregon wine? And they said they had tasted one Oregon wine.
Really?
From Irie. But that is a leap of faith if you've only tasted one and you go out and plant 10 acres.
Well, I want to paint a little picture for our Australian listeners in tribute to the fact that your wife is Australian and you've spent some time out, because we're reminded of Dr. Andrew Pirie, who you can, of course, hear interviewed on the menu from the last time we were in Australia in 2008. This property is very reminiscent of the Piper's Brook Vineyard, which he founded. And one thing I remember about that and that made it, and is that it's so beautiful and it's so beautifully tended. Now, a lot of wine properties, the wines are great, but somehow the place looks untidy because making wine is not in itself a tidy process.
Yeah, and I always think with the vineyard too that the cooler your climate, and that would certainly be true of Tasmania being another very cool climate. Anyway, the cooler the climate, the more intense you have to farm, and the more directly upright you have to put your vines. You can't let them fall over and shade each other because there's no room for error in a really cool climate. So when you go to cool climate areas, I guess like Tasmania or here in Oregon, I think you'll tend to see better farming methods.
Okay,
because
really good husbandry of the vines.
Yeah.
And the grape is a fickle one, I understand.
I understand
winemakers in general think the Pinot Noir is a rather fickle grape.
Yeah, I was saying to someone the other day that if you just wanted to start a winery and it didn't matter to you what varietal, why would you ever do Pinot Noir? It's such a tough thing, and yet for me and for my folks and for all my friends here in the Oregon industry, we couldn't imagine doing anything else, because once you get kind of bit by that bug, it becomes your life passion.
And the Burgundians undoubtedly would agree.
Yes, certainly, and we love to save our money and go to pilgrimages to Burgundy and taste some of those great wines. We try. Yeah. The food and the wine together.
Do you have a real favorite from over there?
Oh, gosh.
Like Latache maybe or something like that.
Only if someone else is paying the bill, right?
Right.
But I really like the wines from Domaine Dujac.
Okay.
And in particular they do a lot of whole cluster fermentation, which to me is, we don't do a lot here, ironically, but I think for their climate and for what they do, I really love those wines. Very aromatic.
You're talking climate, and that's every winemaker we talk to. That is a big issue, the climate change issue. Now they're growing wines in England, I never thought I'd live to see a wine made in England.
Yeah.
Have you noticed? Of course, you're pretty extreme. You're so high.
Yeah, and we always say for us up here, we're essentially, on average, about 2 to 3 weeks later than Burgundy, the birthplace of Pinot Noir, and we're ripening later than that. So we're actually a cooler climate than Burgundy even. So we think that, we're fairly well insulated, even if it does get warmer. What we don't like is and we've seen this in the last 10 years, is a lot more extreme. So a really hot vintage and then a really cool vintage.
Yeah.
And it just makes it more difficult to truly make the wines you want to make if you have to deal with the extremes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what you do.
There's things in the winery, different picking times and different, ways to make the wine, but for the most part, we tend to like the cooler vintages that have a little more elegance, a little lower alcohol.
So if it gets too hot, that raises the alcohol and that gives you a bigger wine.
Yeah, and
which is harder to manage, I guess.
Yeah, I like wine Pinot Noir to be kind of in the middle there with it still has to have elegance and brightness of fruit, and I think that you need a cool climate to do that. And we certainly hope that Oregon will remain a cool climate.
No guarantees.
Right.
Well, this has been a wonderful pilgrimage for us, and such a pleasure to meet you, Adam, and to get your story. Listeners, there is a website that you can go to get access to the wines if they can be shipped to you, and join the Roosevelt Club. What's that URL, Adam?
It's elkcove.com. And also anybody that I guess is able to make it out to Oregon, we love to see visitors, and it is a beautiful property. So
it sure is
worth making it out.
Well, thank you for joining us on the menu, and now perhaps we'll be back after another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And our next winery, Willa Kenzie, is another fascinating story. Itself also a family story of how someone got into wine in a big way, in a most unusual manner, and not entirely expecting things would work out the way they have, which is really wonderfully.
Anne and Peter first discovered Willa Kenzie, famous for Pinot Noir, in Oregon at a wine tasting of a wine group that we belong to, and the leader of the wine group was, shall we say, a Burgundy bigot. So if he was serving Oregon Pinot Noir, we figured it had to be pretty good. We enjoyed it, and we had the opportunity to taste the wine a number of times since then, and now we're catching up with what I thought was a true French connection, but it's not entirely true. So Ronnie LaCroute certainly sounds like a French lady. She apparently speaks fluent French, but there's a U.S. connection. Ronnie, tell us the story.
All right. I'm an American, but I spent a number of years being educated in France and living abroad because my father was in the diplomatic service. We drank wine at table from way back, and I think of myself as equally French as American. I actually have both passports to this day.
And yeah, we won't tell the State Department that.
It's totally legal.
Yeah, I have two too.
Yeah, and I have two as well.
All right. Yes.
So.
And wine has been part of my life forever and ever. Actually, my great-grandmother made wine in the basement of our house when I was a little girl growing up for home consumption. So it was just sort of a natural thing as a retirement project that I get into wine. And it's fortuitous that Oregon still had a huge amount of plantable land left in 1990 when I first came as a tourist to do some wine tasting in Oregon.
So you were in California at that time, and I guess your retirement plan was to sink $5 or $10 million into a vineyard in California.
No, the retirement plan actually was simply to find a place to plant a few grapes.
Okay.
At minor expense. Somehow that got out of control.
Yeah. It's like Dr. Campbell at Elk Cove.
Yeah.
We were there on the same day when we missed you at the winery, and his son Adam said, "Dad, why are you doing this? You never even tasted any Oregon wine." And apparently, that wasn't entirely true. He had actually tasted one Pinot Noir for Oregon before he decided to plant 10,000 plants or something like that.
Well, we went completely berserk, and in the first year we planted, in 1992, we planted 20 acres. In the second year, we planted 20 more. So within 2 years, we had 40 acres of vines, and then we kept going. And we had 125 acres of vines. So it was imperative that we build a winery.
Right. Now, who were the players in this? Did you have a winemaker that you hired, or did you just say, we're going to be able to do that ourselves?
No, we never intended to be winemakers. Neither Bernard nor I had any training in winemaking, simply in wine consumption. So we had both professional vineyard management, courtesy first of Joel Myers, who had planted the Irie vineyards way back in the early days of Oregon wine, the pioneers, and then he brought in, after that, Daniel Fay, fourth-generation Swiss vineyard manager. So that went very well. And when it was time to make wine, Laurent Montalieu, a true Frenchman, showed up at our doorstep. Heard you have a lot of vines. It's time you'd have a winery and a winemaker. And he proposed his services. Checking his references, we were duly impressed, and we hired him.
Now, was he a Burgundian?
No, actually, he was raised in Guadeloupe and went to winemaking school in Bordeaux, but had then worked in Oregon for 6 years when we found him and had been making Pinot Noir.
Well, what serendipity. You certainly were intended to be where you are now.
Something was meant to be, because it just sort of happened. And when it was time for Laurent to move on to his own project, he brought us, actually, somebody who had gone to the same winemaking school in Bordeaux, Thibault Mandet. He came in first as an intern, an assistant winemaker to Laurent, and then he became our full-time winemaker, which he still is today. He's been with us for about 10 years now. Wow.
And you're pleased with how it turned out, I'll bet.
We are thrilled with how it turned out.
Now, this is not just a Pinot Noir story, although Pinot Noir is the big part of the story. So it started out with Pinot Noir, but you then branched out into a number of other white grapes.
We started out in our first year of planting with six varieties. We took some risks based on what we had tasted in 1990. We planted, year one, Pinot Meunier to do red wine, not to do sparkling. We never intended sparkling to be part of the project. And in 93, our second year planting, we planted Gamay Noir. We had already planted Pinot Gris, Pinot Blanc, and Chardonnay in the first year. So that makes six varietals.
There you go. And you're making wines from all of those, except the tasting we had didn't have any Gamay in that. So did that bite the bullet?
No, we still have Gamay Noir, and actually it's in the tasting room as we speak today. And very popular.
And that's a Beaujolais region grape, typically.
It's a Beaujolais region grape, can be made in two different styles. Most of it is fermented in steel and released young, but the very best grapes are actually aged in oak barrels, exactly like Pinot Noir, given plenty of time in the winery, and released as a big, dense, delicious wine in the Beaujolais Cru style. And that's what we do.
Great. Now, the Meunier, that's a little bit unusual to be made into a red wine. Isn't it? I mean,
there are about five wineries in the world we taste it that way.
Exactly. We taste it, and it tasted excellent, but it's usually used as a blending grape in making champagne, correct?
It is, in France, only a blending grape for champagne, but what I discovered, it actually has two skin. The researchers at Cornell University have determined it has a white skin and a black. The white skin gives it the crispness of a white wine, the acidity of a white wine. The red skin gives it flavor and aroma profile of a red wine. So there you have a red wine that, instead of being a huge tannic monster, is actually, how should I say, it's lively, it's fruit-forward, it's refreshing. It's fantastic, a little bit chilled as a summer red.
This is all just such a wonderful dream come true, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. More than what we expected.
Do you live on the property?
Well, my ex-husband lives on the property. I live nearby, and I'm here every day, all day, during the workday. So I still consider this home.
Ah, oh, that's great.
Yeah, excuse the sounds from the street. We seem to have neighbors who are honking their horns in the street next to the studio. So that's what the sound was. At least I think it was on this end, not your end.
Okay, it was not on this end.
It wasn't yours. You're in such a bucolic spot.
Yes. You might hear some cows mooing if you listen carefully here.
I think the tasting room is really very enjoyable. I liked your tasting room a lot.
Oh, good. We had run out of flat land when we built that tasting room recently. Mm-hmm. So that didn't deter us from building. What we did was make a structure that's entirely on piers hanging over a hillside. So the tasting room, as well as the deck and the whole area for outdoor picnics, is elevated off the land and overlooking the vineyards.
Well, we were talking to some of the other tasters, and that your club seems to be popular.
Quite. Keeps growing. We do a lot of educational events. So besides simply furnishing people with samples of all of our small bottlings of wine, we also have seminars where they can learn about the latest techniques for winemaking and vineyard management, and also food and wine pairings.
Now, do you at all compare your wine to Pinot Noir from New Zealand or Pinot Noir from Burgundy? I mean, do you make that comparison at all? Or are you just saying, no, it's an Oregon Pinot Noir and that's good enough?
Well, we do educational tastings where we'll taste across the various regions of the world that make Pinot Noir.
So okay.
An attempt to recognize which style corresponds to which region. But we don't try to reference another region as being somewhat like ours.
Well, no, because you don't have
to. That doesn't make sense. Conditions are so different from one region to the next.
Exactly. Now, but but in the in Oregon Pinot Noirs, there are some differences and some similarities. So Willackenzie is a well-known name. That there are a number of other well-known names like Rex Hill and Chehalem and Elk Cove and people like that. Do you at all compare your wines with them?
Oh, absolutely. But we're all in a series of six sub-appellations, each of which has distinct characteristics. So when comparing, we also have to reference the sub-appellation.
Right, and which what's the one that you're in called?
We're in the Yamhill Carlton area.
Okay.
And Yamhill Carlton is on a marine sediment that was under the ocean at one point and then rose, giving us a soil that is extremely well-drained. Generally needs some irrigation to establish the vines because it's sand. It also intensifies the flavors of the wine because there's absolutely no nutrient capacity in that soil.
So the roots have to go way down.
The roots go way down, and the vines work hard for a living.
Now, this is not the Jory sub-appellation.
No, Jory
is a separate
soil.
And
it's a different one altogether. Ridges away from our main estate. We actually, as a side note, have one bottling coming from the Jory soil because we have a second vineyard actually over in Dundee, and we make one bottling from Pinot Noir that we grow on that farm.
And when you're there tasting, you get to taste several different. Well, I think we tasted about five different ones.
Yeah, we make six vineyard designates of Pinot Noir that each have different characteristics, simply from the part of this one vineyard, our estate vineyard, that we're tasting.
Now, this wine is truly delicious, listeners. You have to understand. We visited Willackenzie because we had tasted a couple of their wines before. We hadn't tasted the full range. We enjoyed doing that very much, and so we'd encourage you to do the same thing. But
how about giving them a spell it out the website?
Yes, let's do that. And then there was something else I was going to say, which I forgot, but I'll get it back again while you're doing the website for us.
Yeah, Brian, can you do the?
Okay, website? Certainly. Our website, Willackenzie.com. Willackenzie.com. Willackenzie is the soil type.
Oh, okay.
So we grow all our own grapes. We reference the soil and give it credit.
Great. Now, the question I was going to ask is, and you're a better person to ask than anybody else because you probably drank every vintage you made since the very first one.
Right.
But how do the wines age? Do they last and do they develop? What happens to them?
Very interestingly, these are wines that last a very long time. Especially anything grown on Willackenzie soil seems to be holding well. We did a tasting of every vintage we made. None of them have yet completely faded. The early vintages, 95 and 96, are still alive, fruit forward, and drinking well.
Wow.
Okay, but you only have at this point you only have since.
Well, you have
since,
to have
since
collected
1995.
Those and put them in your cellar because we don't have enough left. We might have a case.
you better be careful. We were in the Loire Valley in France, and we visited the caves where the wines are stored at this particular vineyard, and they have some 19th century wines.
Oh my!
But they only open them when there's a child, when there's a great grandchild born.
Right. Wow.
So
truly impressive.
We have a little to learn yet, probably in this country about aging wines. But for those of you listeners who have not explored Oregon Pinot Noir, as you should. I mean, it's just really that simple. It's they're delightful wines. They're a very clear, bright expression of Pinot Noir. Goes with everything. Goes with halibut. Goes with steak. Goes with cheese. Goes with just a glass in your hand. Don't you think?
I would totally agree with that. But the risk is that you fall in love with it so much that you do like us. And you come out to Oregon wine country to see where it comes from, and you fall in love with it, and you never leave.
That's right.
Well, it's been wonderful finally catching up with you, Ronnie.
Well, I've enjoyed this also.
Next time we're back in your area, we will give you advance notice and appear on your doorstep again.
Please do that. I'd love to meet you in person.
Great.
Thank you so much,
Ronnie. Thanks,
Ronnie.
You're very welcome.
And stay with us because there's more to come after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and our next guest has a new dog, too.
Well, actually, vineyards, there's a whole book about dogs and their vineyards, or
they do.
Vineyards and their dogs.
The interesting thing about it is that Mike Stevenson from Panther Creek doesn't have a vineyard, but he does have a dog.
He has a dog.
He's a really nice new dog.
A wonderful dog.
A fascinating winery in beautiful downtown McMinnville in what used to be the old power station. And you'll hear more about that during our interview with Mike. We've talked to him before, and he's such a fascinating, down-to-earth man. We just couldn't leave wine country without talking to him again about what he's up to just now. So here's Mike Stevenson from Panther Creek.
When On the Menu met Michael Stevenson for the first time, it was in our turf, in Pennsylvania. So we always promised if we were back in his turf in Oregon, we'd come by and say hello. So here we are in beautiful downtown McMinnville, in a building that wasn't ever a winery, Michael, correct?
Yeah, this was the power plant for the city of McMinnville.
And your tasting person was saying that you're thinking about naming a wine in honor of it?
Yeah, we are thinking about making a different label, a less expensive wine, and I think Power Station Pinot is what they've come up with for that.
But it will be a Pinot Noir?
Oh, yeah, that's all we make.
That's all you make, okay.
And you know, you haven't said the name of the winery yet, which is Panther Creek.
It's Panther Creek, and you would think Panther Creek would be out in the middle of the country. Sounds like it.
Well, it is. The guy who started this winery is Ken Wright, and he has Ken Wright Cellars right now in Carlton.
Oh, okay.
And the story I heard was that he was at Nick's Italian Cafe late at night with Nick and John West and other people, and trying to think of what to call his new business. And they said, how about Panther Creek Cellars? Because he lived on Panther Creek Road. And so he called it that. And then when he sold the business in 94, they were at Golden Valley talking about the same thing. And they said, how about Ken Wright Cellars? Because, you know, your name is, it's a known name now. And so he calls it Ken Wright Cellars.
And he's gone on to be pretty successful.
Oh, yeah, he's very successful. He's a great marketer. He's a great winemaker. He's a great person. His wines are, he's learned a lot from his Panther Creek experiences. I think his wines are very forward, very lush, very round, and they're beautifully drinking wines.
Yeah, but your model is you buy fruit and you buy from quite a number of different vineyards. How many altogether?
I have no idea. I've been here since 94, and the number of vineyards has changed throughout the last 17 years, but usually 8 to 10.
Now, do you do that? You do the buying?
I don't pay the bills.
No, but you select the grapes that you want.
Yeah, the lots, yes.
The lots. Okay.
The blocks.
So you're looking at particular lots you've sort of grown familiar with over the years?
Yeah, I hope so. We already had blocks that we purchased in 94, and over the past few years, when I was made the winemaker, then it was my job to go out and inspect these vineyards and learn about what was going on there. And pretty much that's what I do.
So now you are actually a son of North Carolina.
Yep, I'm from
Asheville.
And
you came west, northwest, to make beer, but you never got there, huh?
Yeah, I moved out here to make beer in 93. But I already had a job at Flynn Vineyards, which is down near Riccreol, about 20 minutes south of here. And I just stayed in the winemaking industry.
And you became a winemaker because just of all the years of experience that you had? Or?
I don't know. There was no plan for any of this, and there still isn't. You know, I am the winemaker here, and you know, this is a great place. I love the state of Oregon. I love Yamhill County and McMinnville. I have great friends here, and I have no desire to get another job, move elsewhere. I feel very lucky that I'm the winemaker here.
If you were to describe the Michael Stevenson style of Pinot Noir, how would you describe it?
Well, I don't have a style of wine that I'm trying to make. I think what I like most about Pinot Noir is the same thing that I love the most about Riesling, from my experience, that's because both those varietals, they speak about when and where they were grown. And I think if I'm trying to, I don't try to make a wine be something it's not. That's why the wine critics are so frustrating, because they don't seem to understand the vintage variability that we have in this part of the country.
And there's a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
But what you're saying is you're looking for the expression of the grape you have in the crusher.
Oh, yeah.
And then saying, okay, I want to take that and represent it in the wine.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, I'm just a,
you're like a concert.
Like a guardian or something. Right. I mean, I'm not, the winemaker is kind of a ridiculous term. I mean, yeast are winemakers. I'm not a winemaker. But
I'm
just trying to, I'm trying to maintain, do use what we have here in terms of our equipment to make the best wine possible, and that's just what is in that, that vintage in that vineyard. That's it.
So people can expect in your wines year to year variation and.
Oh yeah, well yeah. But every vineyard has its own set of flavors and set of aromas, and that stays constant. I mean, that's one thing. We don't use much new oak. I think we just bought, this year we'll probably use about 20%, and for another label that I make here, we don't use any. And I don't really think that, I don't really like new oak, and I don't like it in Pinot Noir very much, because it's not a vineyard flavor, it's not a vineyard aroma, you know.
Now, what do they do in Burgundy? I asked the question out of ignorance.
Oh, they do everything we do and more. I mean, they've been making Pinot Noir there for.
But they're not using new oak either.
Oh yeah, yeah, they yeah. They have yeah. There are Pinot Noir. There are Burgundy producers which use 100% new oak. There are Burgundy producers which use none. It runs the gamut.
Okay, and you've got this mixture yourself.
Yeah, I don't. I just don't like new oak, and okay. I really believe that Pinot Noir is the most interesting red grape I've ever had because it does tell you about where and when it was grown. And there's no oak flavor in wine before a human puts it there.
Right.
And there's no oak aroma in Pinot Noir either. And I don't really think that Pinot Noir needs it.
Well, what kinds of things do Pinot Noirs say about where they were grown?
Well, in this part of Oregon, we have a series of hillsides, the Red Hills of Dundee, the Eola and Amity Hills, and that's igneous rock. It's clay, jory clay soil, and very different from the west of here, which are uplifted seabeds like Freedom Hill, very different than Shea Vineyard, which is all sedimentary soils, because this, it's my understanding that 12,000 years ago there were a series of floods which came down from Lake Missoula in Montana and Canada, and these huge glaciers, they started to warm up, they melted from the inside out, and so there was this massive block of water, and this ice dam gave way, and so the water flooded out of there and down into this part of the country, and I think that probably happened 30 times. I don't know, but I'm just going by what I've heard.
Geologically, geomorphologically, I believe you're absolutely correct.
Oh, okay, well, thank you.
The curious thing, just on a note of being a geographer myself, is that in Europe, in particular, people attributed the kinds of soils and other deposits that derive from that with Noah's flood from the Old Testament.
Well,
and it was the longest time before people actually understood, as you expressed it, that in fact it was as a result of the thawing of the last ice age.
Yes.
But regardless, what that did was it carried deposits that were strange.
Oh yeah, very much so. They were
moved them, and moved them further if they were silty because the grain of the deposits were smaller, mm-hmm. so it would be carried further by the water.
Yeah, and the Shehalem Hills, the east side of that is very different than the west side. The east side of those hills, the winds that blow through the Columbia Gorge blow silt and loess, so these very thin soils, and they're very airy, and they blow and they just pile up against the east side of the Shehalem Hills. The west side is very different. You know, okay. They don't blow over and collect over there too. The west side has is just very different weather pattern. So I think that they're going to keep. I bet we continue to narrow our AVAs down more and more. Instead of just the Shehalem Hills, Shehalem Mountain, there'll be a. It'll probably be redefined into a sub AVA at some point.
So there are a series of AVAs in Oregon.
Oh yes.
How many altogether?
I don't know. I probably 8 or 10.
Okay. And you're making from more than one of those.
Yeah,
even though you're in McMinnville, I noticed you have a Pinot Noir that's dedicated to Shea,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the...
Yeah, that's the Yamhill Carlton AVA. The Red Hills of Dundee is an AVA that we make fruit, we make wine from. The McMinnville Foothills west of town is an AVA that we use also. And then Freedom Hill is a vineyard that's down southwest of here. It's what used to be underwater, and now it's uplifted coastal bed. And that's not an AVA yet, but it will be at some point.
Now, how widely distributed is Smith Creek? I mean, how easy is it for people to get it across the country?
I think it's pretty easy. I mean, even in Pennsylvania, where I first met you guys, that's a great market for us. I've heard that the Pennsylvania system is difficult, and people like to complain about it, but it's good for me because you can meet everybody you need to know pretty easily instead of making...
I've seen your wines in our local store, which interestingly, is the fourth largest gross of all the state stores in the Commonwealth. What as Pennsylvanians we complain about is the limit we have on choice.
Yeah, and I can understand it. And I mean, there's no perfect system for getting wine, I guess, but it is a I don't really like to travel and market wine. I'd rather be here in the winery.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when that's the only market I go to these days. And it's I go for a week and go to the three Pennsylvania wine festivals, have a great time, and then come back here. And so I like that market a lot.
Okay. Well, we may see you next April. Have we seen you there? I don't know whether we have. There are so many winemakers there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's...
We might have waved hi.
Or... Unless you knew I was there, I have no idea. It's hard. You can't even go and try all the wines there.
No, you can't.
I mean, it's at Heinz Field in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes,
and that's probably the best of the three, I think.
Yeah, I think it is too.
Everybody
seems to agree.
Yeah, it's just the people that go to it. It's I think if Philadelphia is a huge city and it's near D.C. and Boston, and, you know, there's so much going on in that part of the country, and Pittsburgh is more like the Midwest than the Northeast, I think, and people take it very seriously there.
But generally across the country, people will be able to find Panther Creek wines?
Yep, or they can go online at www.panthercreekcellars.com and okay. Just contact me, and I'll return their email.
Okay, and then you can tell them where they can find
mm-hmm.
it. And do you also fulfill via...
Oh, yep, we ship.
So you can ship as well
yep.
to states that allow that to happen.
Yep.
Ours, of course, not being one of those. But
well, not yet.
Life's like that sometimes.
Yes.
You sound hopeful. I mean,
I'm hopeful,
some
yeah.
some of your optimism.
That's right.
Now, what's a preview? The 2010 isn't in distribution yet?
No, 2010 is still in the barrel, and it's...
How's it coming?
It's a beautiful vintage, you know. It's kind of like 2007... kind of like 2001,
oh, wow.
And those are, I know they're not, the vintages that people read about are 2006 and 2008, but from my experience, that's because those wines are very forward, they're fairly alcoholic, they're obvious, and I think in my experience here, the best vintages are the ones that I can go and ask a guy like Steve Dorner, who's the winemaker at Christom, and or Mark Vlasic, who's the winemaker at St. Innocent, and they prefer the vintages that there's some knuckle biting going on at the end, you know. And we started off very cold and rainy of this growing season, and that's kind of what it is doing outside right now. But it's going to be a beautiful season. I'd much rather harvest in October than September.
That's okay. Very interesting to know. Yeah.
And the 11s, I guess you just don't.
Well,
know.
It's a lot like 2010 in terms okay. of the growing season. The okay. biggest difference right now is that. The grape clusters are, the berries are of even size from top to bottom. Last year they were small hens and chicks, small and large berries on the same cluster. And there was a lot of shatter too, which is, you know, the berry does not pollinated. And so it shatters, the grape is not formed. That was last year. 2011 though, the grapes are, again, they're very even. The sizes are very even across the cluster, and there's, per acre this year than last year, and I think it'll be a beautiful year.
Okay, so you're optimistic about...
Oh, I'm always optimistic, yeah.
I'm sure you are. And it was a pleasure to have the opportunity to meet with you, and you must let us know when... What's the name of the new wine?
The Power Station Pinot.
That sounds like...
I'll send you a bottle.
That sounds like it's going to be pretty special. Michael, once again, thank you so much for joining us, and of course, welcome back.
Well, that's it for another program. We hope you enjoyed it, and you'll come back and join us in the same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.